It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll discuss the debate over the merits of Elf on the Shelf and why this newly minted holiday tradition is such a polarizing topic in the world of parenting.
First, the percentage of working-age men out of a job has more than tripled since the late 1960s. The unemployment rate for men aged 25 to 54, so-called prime age for wage earning, currently stands at 16%.
While the recent recession can be blamed for a large number of workers losing their jobs, the economic recovery is not bringing this group of male workers back into the workforce.
A recent poll shows that while many working-age men are keen to find new jobs, a large proportion of them are unwilling or unable to go back to work, even though the economy is getting better. Benjamin Applebaum is with us now. He's a reporter with the New York Times. Benjamin, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks very much for having me.
Well, you write that 16% of prime-age American men aren't working. How significant is that number compared with levels of working prime-age men in recent years?
It's a huge increase over the last half century. If you go back to the 1960s, more than 95% of men in this age group, their prime working years, were working. They had jobs. So it's basically tripled since then. It rose as high as 20% during the years immediately after the recession. Now come back a little bit to 16%, but this is still, it's the highest level we've seen in the entire history of this country.
I guess the big question is why? What factors have shifted in society and the economy that this number has tripled?
Yeah, there's no one explanation for it, but in broad terms, we're seeing sort of the confluence of two things. One is a weaker economy, and in particular, a hollowing out of the type of jobs that are available. So that in particular, workers who don't have a college education, whose skills may be manual and technical, are having a hard time finding work as manufacturing jobs have gone overseas. There are a lot of low-wage jobs in retail and a lot of high-wage jobs for people with education, but that sort of middle space where a high school graduate used to be able to make a middle-class living in a car factory in Detroit or doing something else, that has really gone away. And then the other set of factors that are interesting is that it's become, in some respects, a little bit easier to get by without working. This country has a social safety net that's designed to help people who can't find work, and in particular, the disability program has increased in recent years. And, you know, the ability of people to take advantage of that, to get by, the cost of entertainment has declined. And interestingly, a lot of men are not in families anymore. They're not providing for other people. They're living by themselves. They're single. If they have children, they don't live with those children. And so that has reduced the burden on them as well and made it easier not to work. So you have this sort of odd confluence of a lack of opportunities and a little bit less of a lack of need.
There's some polling data out there that shows that some of these men have decided not to go back to work, would choose that even if they could go back to work. Why would someone choose to stay unemployed?
This is very striking. This is one of the findings that surprised me most. But as I talked to many of these men, it became clear that what we're seeing is that for many of these men, low-wage work is simply not worth it. And there's sort of two elements to it. The first, economically, is what I was describing a moment ago, which is that it has become a little bit easier to get by without working. And in particular, if you're making $7 or $8 an hour, by the time you include the cost of your commute, the cost of getting to work, perhaps the cost of providing a uniform, you're not necessarily making that much money at all from a job like that. And if the alternative is sitting at home and not incurring those costs, it can be surprisingly close in terms of the advantages of actually having a job. There's also a pride issue for a lot of these men. We heard this in particular, you know, from men who perhaps had worked in manufacturing or construction for years and years and are now confronted with the option of working at a McDonald's or in a retail setting. The idea of being on public display is really uncomfortable for a lot of them. It doesn't comport with their idea of who they are, their sense of identity. And for many of them, even if it involves some measure of sacrifice, they would rather not put themselves into that position.
Now, you spent a lot of time talking to men, finding out what their experience was like. What were some of the takeaways that they told you about what their experience was like being part of this new group of men that isn't working?
So I think one of the things that surprised me most, which we were just talking about, is this sense that many of the men have of a pride that extends beyond sort of whatever would be the best thing for them to do economically, that for many of them, there are considerations other than just how can I make the most money. They're concerned about their sense of dignity and of place in the world and of respect. One of the very interesting things we found is that Men overwhelmingly report that if they're out of work, they spend, and they have children, they spend more time with those children. But they also overwhelmingly say that that is not good for their children. They seem to perceive themselves as primarily breadwinners and as role models, and if they can't fill those roles, then just the opportunity to spend more time with their children doesn't seem to them as good for their children. It's also interesting how scarred many of these men are by losing work. I was struck by how many of them remember the exact date that they lost work, even if it happened years ago. They remember it immediately and precisely. Many of them report that their mental health has suffered. They're very frustrated by their inability to earn a living. They report, you know, weight gain. They're not exercising. Men spend about half of the time that they previously spent working, either sleeping or engaged in what are called passive leisure activities, which basically means, you know, watching TV or playing video games. So it's really a huge toll on their lives.
We know that jobs, you know, in a bigger sense, they're not just jobs. Wrapped up in being employed is a sense of identity and self-worth. So given that this large number of men is unemployed now, do you think we're going to see a reverb effect in terms of identity crisis and self-worth crisis with American men?
There's no question that this has taken a huge toll on the psyche of these men and on their mental health. We asked men about a series of impacts on their lives, whether being out of work had affected their friendship, their relationships, their physical health, their relationship with their children, a whole range of things. And the thing that they said had been most affected was their mental health. That was the area where they felt the greatest impact from being out of work. And it's clear why. It's a country in which we're, you know, taught from a young age that people are defined in large part by what they do. And for many of these men, there was a sense of pride in what they did. An electrician I talked to who, you know, had spent years investing in becoming an electrician and training and was proud for his son to come to work with him and see what he did. Now he says, like, I don't know what to tell people. I'm not an electrician anymore. There's a real sense of pain in hearing things like that, a real sense of lost purpose and degraded dignity that I think a lot of these men are really struggling with.
As the economy slowly recovers, do you see some of these men rebounding back into the market again?
So the pattern is pretty clear that some of these men will probably be able to find new jobs as the economy recovers, but also that some of them will not. What we've seen over the last half century is this repeated pattern in which downturns in the economy push a lot of people out of work, and then the recovery brings only some of them back. And so the net effect is that we end up with a smaller share of this population working than worked during the previous boom. So things will get better. It'll go down a little bit from 16%, but if history is any guide, it won't go all the way. And a big reason for that is that being out of work really costs you in terms of your ability to return. There's a fascinating study from Sweden showing that men who are out of work gradually lose their ability to read because they're just not doing it as much. And this happens with other skills, too. When you're out of the workforce, you start to lose the ability to do the job that you previously did, and you're not training to do other jobs, and it means that you become less valuable to potential employers. Many of these men also settle into sort of alternative life paths. They go on federal disability and are reluctant to relinquish those benefits, or they start to think of themselves as retired, and that becomes their identity. And so it becomes irreversible the longer it goes on.
I want to go back to something you said. They lose their ability to read?
This is an amazing study, and it really struck me when I first read it. But it's typical of a body of literature that shows that as men are out of work, they tend not to be doing very much with their time. They tend to be sitting around, sleeping, watching television. Women who are out of work are much more likely to be actively engaged in volunteering or childcare or housework or other activities. Men tend to be sedentary, and we see their skills atrophy. Reading is a very striking example of it. They literally lose their ability in terms of reading comprehension, but it happens with other kinds of skills, too. If you're not doing things, you lose the ability to do them, and it's really one of the striking costs of unemployment.
Now, you said part of this is that a lot of these men are not fathers because the institution of marriage has declined, so they may not have children. Some of them do, of course, but for those that don't, for those that are fathers, how do you see this as affecting their children, the next generation of children coming up?
So there's an important distinction there, which is that we haven't actually seen a decline in the likelihood that these men will be fathers. What has declined is the likelihood that they will be living with their child or contributing to their child's upbringing. So we've seen a real increase in mothers who are primarily responsible for raising their children without the presence of a father figure. And that's the pattern. But the impact on the next generation is one of the most depressing things about this. There was a lot of good research done in the early 1990s during that recession, tracing forward the impact on children of a loss of work among their parents, and in particular their fathers. And there's a lot of good evidence that the impact carries through to the next generation, that the children suffer in turn, are more likely to lose their own jobs, are less likely to find high-paying work, or less their lives are likely to, you know, be less successful as a consequence of the fact that their parents were unemployed. And the longer that spell of unemployment lasts, the worse it gets. It really seems to disrupt their upbringing in a way that is enormously consequential in the long term. Those 90 studies were based on a relatively small downturn. If it proves to be the case that this pattern holds during the current downturn, which was much, much longer, it has lasted much, much longer, it really could be a devastating event of a kind that I don't think we really understand has happened just yet. It could really scar a significant portion of the population over the next generation.
Have you put your finger on anything that could potentially turn this trend around in the next decade or so?
So there are some opportunities to help people get back into the labor force. And in talking to these people who are out of work, it was striking how many of them saw ways in which employers could accommodate them, could help them to get back to work. Job training programs, good ones, have a track record of helping people find new jobs. Accommodations for people with disabilities can be an important way of helping some people get back into the workforce, for women in particular, but increasingly for some men as well. Accommodations that are designed to help people take care of their families, so childcare or flexible work hours are arrangements that can be powerful as well. Listen, we saw this happen in the late 1990s when the economy was much stronger and employers were so hungry for labor, they began reaching out to potential employees and trying to find ways of bringing them back into the workforce. So what that underscores is that what we need most of all is a stronger economy. When the economy is growing more quickly, when there's more demand for workers, it starts to pull people back, even if there are obstacles in their way. If the economy remains weak, as it has been in recent years, there's much less incentive for employers to make those efforts, much less opportunity for people who, you know, may be separated from the workforce by a fairly minor obstacle to overcome even that. And so a lot really turns on the broader health of the economy.
Benjamin, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Benjamin Applebaum is a New York Times reporter. He wrote an article on the vanishing American male worker in the Atlantic.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert.
The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission held a hearing in Washington, D.C. yesterday about the effect rail delays are having on coal deliveries. As Danielle Kading reports, it's a pressing issue for utilities that service here in Wisconsin.
Last winter's polar vortex and rail delays packed a 1-2 punch for utility providers in the Midwest. Todd Ramey is vice president of the Mid-Continent Independent System Operators, or MISO, which monitors the grid in the Midwest. He told commissioners that 1/3 of utilities they represent are conserving coal inventories.
Some of the steps taken to maintain and restore coal piles have included limiting output at certain coal-fired plants, and in a few cases, taking some units completely offline.
Ramey says coal conservation has increased electricity prices by almost 9% from a year ago. Dairyland Power Cooperative provides electricity to roughly 500,000 people through their 25 members across Wisconsin and the Midwest. Spokeswoman Katie Thompson says they're seeing higher costs.
The higher cost of having to purchase electricity to compensate for this loss in generation from the marketplace. The cost to purchase coal, the lost revenue from electricity we might have sold into the market had we been operating under our normal practices.
Thompson says coal deliveries to their Genoa plant have helped inventories in the last few months, but she says they're still worried about rail shipments to their Alma plant. Dairyland Power may conduct scheduled outages to ensure there's enough coal to meet peak demand this winter, which could have a snowball effect for members like Bayfield Electric Cooperative. CEO Diane Berweger says they buy electricity from Dairyland to serve their 8,900 members.
If Dairyland Power can't have adequate coal supply, they will have to go out onto the market to purchase power, which will cost Bayfield Electric members more money.
Berweger says they haven't had a rate increase for 3 years and they're not looking to raise rates in 2015. But she says Bayfield Electric is absorbing costs passed to them by Dairyland Power. BNSF Railway Vice President Steve Bob told the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission rail maintenance, expansion, and increasing demand contributed to delays. Bob says utility customers requested around 286 million tons of coal for shipment this year, and they're starting to gain ground.
The increased availability of key resources, track, people, and locomotives is driving the faster train speeds for late November and month to date.
But that's not enough for some utility providers who want to see the Surface Transportation Board promote more competition and transparency. Congress created the STB in the 90s to oversee rail rates and service issues. Michael Higgins is the deputy director of their Rail Customer and Public Assistance Program.
If certain conditions are met and apply to a significant service failure causing a regional problem of significant magnitude, we do have the authority to implement measures that would direct traffic or prioritize service.
Bob with BNSF says regulatory action won't help the railroad increase capacity. The company announced plans last month to invest $6 billion over the next year for maintenance and expansion in hopes of improving service. XL Energy Field Supply Operations Director Craig Romer says the railroad is also working with them to ship 1,000 more tons of coal per train to Minnesota's largest power plant.
Because of their increased siding lengths and the amount of track that they put in the ground, now they can handle the bigger sized trains, and our facility can unload those bigger sized trains. It was built for that.
Romer is hopeful they've turned a corner. The railroad's Bob says they're confident BNSF has laid the track necessary to keep commerce chugging along, no matter what winter throws their way. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio in Superior.
All right, now we got a sensitive holiday parenting issue, and a spoiler alert is coming. So if you've got young children listening, you might want to cover their ears.
Okay, all clear? Great, because we're going to talk about a relatively recent holiday tradition that delights some people and some parents and elicits loathing in other people.
Yeah, it's this elf on a shelf thing. This kind of snuck up on me. It's been growing in popularity in recent years. Pinterest, all sorts of pictures of creative and fun ideas using the elf magic, the elf on a shelf. And there's been pushback from some parents, some writers, one article saying that Elf on a Shelf is the greatest fraud ever pulled on children.
And parents, we want you to tell us what you think about this one. Does your family take part in the Elf on the Shelf new tradition? Do you think it's harmless fun or is it a total fraud? You can give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Aisha Sultan joins us now. She's a syndicated parenting columnist at the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Aisha, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
So this thing, Elf on a Shelf, has been around for a while. Like I said, it was pretty new to me. What is Elf on a Shelf?
The Elf on the Shelf is a doll that you buy. It's like $30. It's a doll and it comes with a book. And the elf makes its appearance the day after Thanksgiving, and you hide it every, the parents hide it every day in a different spot. And allegedly, the magical elf reports on the kids' behaviors every night to Santa Claus in the North Pole. So it's sort of this, and then the elf finds itself in all kinds of mischief and funny scenarios or situations that parents dream up and I guess have the time and energy to do every day from the day after Thanksgiving until Christmas, Christmas Eve, I suppose. And so, yeah, it was in 2005 that the book and this doll came out, and it's had $10 million in annual sales since then. And it's become a huge thing, like you said, on social media, Pinterest. But the funny thing is, so last year, I wrote a feature story for the Post-Dispatch about 30 creative ideas for your Elf on the Shelf. And that was one of our most read stories online from the entire year. I think it got over a million hits.
We had
this gallery. And then that story ran all over the country. Because I think at some point you start running out of ideas about what to do with this elf. And you have to keep your kids entertained. And they go on the playground. And they talk about what their elf did and what did your elf do. And I think that has started to spring some of the backlash towards it.
So let's talk about that backlash. For people who are backlashing, what do they object to?
Okay, there are a few things. First of all, I mean, would you want to commit to 30 days of extra work in your house? I think if you have young children, especially the holiday season, it's kind of exhausting just by the end of the day, let alone to have to come up with some creative new idea or stunt for this elf to do. And some parents, well, you know how certain things get on Pinterest, this competitive suburban parenting arms race, and the elf does ever elaborate things. Like, we've seen hot tubs of created in the sink full of marshmallows with a Barbie in there, and you see messes, things broken, the tree disheveled. I mean, the elf comes around and creates this big mess, and then who has to clean it all up? So on one hand, there's the argument of this is just creating a lot more work and stress and anxiety for parents who already have a lot to do at this time of year. Second of all, another objection is that this like sort of creepy behavior control, because your kids are being told that this thing is watching them and reporting on them every single day. Now, for some kids, that might not be a deterrent, but for other kids, it might be a little creepy or unnerving or scary. And there have been some parents who've said that, oh, my kids did not like this idea of this elf watching them, and that message that that sent. And I think lastly, and probably the most valid criticism, is that it teaches kids at a time of year when, you know, it's about giving and caring and religious beliefs that you need to be good because someone's watching, and if you're good, you'll get.
And we're going to have to hit pause right there. Aisha, I'm sorry, we're going to come back and pick up this conversation. And we want to hear from you. What about Elf on the Shelf? Do you embrace it, or do you think it's a problem and extra work and surveillance-y? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll get to your calls after the news. This is Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking right now with parenting columnist Aisha Sultan about the ongoing debate over the holiday fad Elf on the Shelf. And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you think about this relatively new holiday practice? Do you think it's harmless fun, or do you see some serious issues with it? The idea being the elf appears sometime after Thanksgiving, reports back each night to Santa at the North Pole, and then comes back in a new place, making some new mischief the next day. Let us know at 800-642-1234.
We'll go right to our callers. We've got Jill on the line in Madison. Jill, hi.
Hello.
So what's your take on Elf on the Shelf,
well,
Jill?
I'm a teacher. I teach the 4-year-old kindergarten at my school, and I tell you, I have used the elf in a positive way. I did read the book and did not like, you know, all of the mischief and all of that, and the good and the bad. I have him looking for the kids that are, you know, making good choices, of course, and good behavior, being kind to each other. He does funny things. He, has a snowball fight with Mr. Potato Head. I use marshmallows and those kinds of things. And then my husband, like yesterday, my husband came to school as the elf coming alive and brought candy canes. And the kids that normally have speech and language issues or have ELL or English language learners were so excited. And these are our little ones that have difficulty speaking and, you know, even expressing their feelings. When he left, they wanted to write him letters and thanking of thanks, pictures, draw pictures. It just was amazing what happened with their imagination and sparked their interest in learning.
That's great, Jill. Thank you so much. And Aisha, I think that's one point here. You don't have to follow the exact rules as given. People are getting creative in different ways with this Elf on the Shelf thing.
You're absolutely right. And Jill sounds like a wonderful teacher.
Well, thanks a lot for that, Jill. And we're going to go next to Cindy. Cindy joins us from De Pere. Hi, Cindy.
Hi. I really liked what the teacher just said, and I think that's a really neat thing to do. The piece that I was feeling was that it sounds very commercial. It sounds like somebody had a great idea just to make some more money, you know, during the holiday season. And then I get to worry about kids from poor families when you're talking about the parents, you know, or the kids on the playground in there. And they're saying, well, what did your elf do? Or what did your elf do? And then it's just one more place where poor kids can get left out because their families can't afford to be doing that as far as money or time. And then they're just like, well, why isn't that elf at my house? And that's just kind of the way I felt.
Right. Interesting point, Cindy. I appreciate that. And Aisha, is that something that you've thought about, too, that this could be something that divides kids according to finances in the house?
Well, I mean, and even Santa, you know, has that unintended consequence. There are always kids who get more and kids who get less or not very much at all. And you're absolutely right. The commercial aspect of this has been criticized roundly because there's a whole line of Elf on the Shelf merchandise that you can buy and different ways to do it. And really the only people, like you said, who have the time and resources to do it are ones who are relatively middle class or affluent. But you're absolutely right about that.
Cindy, thanks for your call at 800-642-1234. You can join in with your thoughts on this Elf on the Shelf phenomenon, harmless holiday fun, or something bad. There's been some pushback on this, saying it's bribery for kids, in effect, rewarding them for good behavior with the promise of presents from Santa. Ashley on Facebook says, never did this before, but I find it adorable and entertaining. I plan to start doing it next year. Why people like to suck the joy out of little fun for kids is beyond me. So, Aisha, any fairness in that? The people criticizing this thing are being a bit of a killjoy.
I think anybody who is able to make this fun and keep this fun in their house, like, power to them. And I think people who feel like it's a little too much or doesn't really feel right to them, they're certainly entitled to that. There's really no point to judge other people's choices when it comes to an elf on the shelf. You know? That's sort of my take on it.
We've got another comment from Jill on Facebook who says, our elf is in charge of Christmas cheer, which means she leaves notes suggesting things we can do, usually good deeds, to help us and others find the Christmas spirit. But I do wish, she says, we'd never started it. I've got enough going on in December. But then I realized I only have about 5 more Christmases at best to do it and decided it wasn't too bad. So Jill kind of getting at that extra work angle that you were talking about. I don't know, some little back and forth on this, even with people who do it.
I think Jill's idea is beautiful, and it's wonderful, and I would love for her elf to come live in my house for a while. But I don't know about you guys, but when you have young kids and, you know, by the time you get through dinner and homework and everything else, activities, everything else you have to do, it just seems like a big commitment to go in for 30 days on, you know, having to put this elf and create it in different places every day. But you know what? Some people love it, and I think it's a creative activity for them to enjoy and do, and it's very cute. So power to them.
Back to our callers now. We've got Rosa on the line in Waterford. Rosa, hi.
Hello.
I'm sorry, Rosa, we're not hearing your connection very well. A note from our producer that Rosa said her husband said the elf was grooming kids for us to live in a surveillance society. The elf is watching. And that's, you touched on this earlier, Aisha. I mean, is this a concern that this notion that you've got this thing, it's in effect spying for Santa?
Isn't Santa supposed to know what we're doing? Whether kids are good and bad anyway, isn't Santa watching all the time? I mean, I think it's just an extension of that idea. And I suppose the thing that makes me uncomfortable is if parents do use this in a punitive way. Like, I know parents that have, you know, said that the kids were so bad they had to ban the elf or send the elf back to the North Pole, and they really try to use it to influence kids' behavior. And I don't know how successful that's going to be in the long run. But, you know, there are plenty of other ways in which kids get the message that everything we do is watched, recorded, stalked, you know, beyond just an elf.
And actually, you wrote a piece last year that featured some creative ideas for Elf on the Shelf, and people, as you said, are getting really creative. What's one of your favorites?
Well, I think it was funny. I think one of the funniest ones that we had was somebody had put the elf in the car that that Barbie drives, and they had them on some kind of racetrack or doing something funny. And then one of the comments, well, not just one, several readers pointed out that in the photo, these were all reader-submitted photos in creative ways they situated the elf. And several people pointed out that the Barbie was topless in the car, and that it was not in good taste for the elf to be riding with a topless Barbie.
Okay, so that's getting into a whole new area of Elf on the Shelf, probably unintentional by the parents, yes. I'm guessing.
I'm sure.
Well, one angle on this, I mean, your readers share their pictures with you, and lots of people are posting their Elf on the Shelf pictures on various social media sites. We mentioned Pinterest earlier. Is social media necessary in a way for the success of this thing?
Certainly it helped the word of mouth. Yeah, you know, absolutely. And then it helps people who do get a little competitive in their craftiness. I realized I have absolutely no reason, like, no room to compete on any of that, on any of those levels, so I never got into it. And I just think it's funny to see the creative things people come up with. But I can see how it might make someone feel like, oh, here's another thing in which I'm failing my children and not doing the Christmas thing with them because I cannot. Okay, so we saw some very elaborate pictures in which they had, like, created this elf hanging from the wall and like rock climbing and like an entire scene built out of, you know, different toys. It was very, you'd be surprised at how elaborate people get with these scenarios.
So people are having fun with it, yeah, presumably by hearing what we're hearing. But is there something to be said for the worry that maybe this is bad parenting technique? Because what happens the day after Christmas and the elf goes home, do the kids just act out and you've sort of lost your tool, your parenting, your leverage?
What? I read that in one of the comments someone posted on an article about that is that, oh, yeah, you know, yeah, sure, my kids are angels up until Christmas. But then the minute the elf is gone and they've gotten the gift from Santa's, then they turn into major brats again and it's impossible to control them. So you do have to think about the way in which you're motivating your kids' behavior. And obviously the best type of motivation is intrinsic, when the child realizes, you know, we want to be good because it's the right thing to do and it feels good to be good and caring and work on that piece of it when it comes to changing your child's behavior. But if you want this to be just a fun tradition that your family does, then by all means, you know, it's not going to turn them, as long as you use it the right way, I don't think that it's a harmful tradition.
Now, my kids were too old for this by the time I found out about it. And I think my creativity would be, okay, today's the elf's on the kitchen chair. Tomorrow it's on the dining room chair.
No.
How about in your house, Aisha? Did you get into Elf on a Shelf? What did you do with it?
Are you kidding me? Like, there's no way I'm adding anything else on my list of things to do. And I asked my children, I was like, so are your, you know, friends talking about Elf on the Shelf? And I think it sort of peaks around kindergarten, first grade, second grade. But then after that, they kind of get wise to it. And so fortunately, mine are in the later grades of elementary school, and I don't feel so guilty.
My mom invented an elf for our family. Shouldn't say invented. She met him, invited him to our home. His name is Metek, which sounds Klingon to me, mm-hmm, not very North Polesy. But he's invisible, which takes some of the work out of it.
That is brilliant. Now, your mom needed to patent and sell that.
I know.
I thought
of that.
On an island right now.
We missed the boat.
Exactly.
Maybe without the Klingon name,
right,
to make it
Metek, the invisible Klingon elf.
Well, it works for us. What can I say?
I will kill you if you are not good, child. Yeah, I don't know, man.
I can't talk anymore.
Gardach.
And now we see why other people are making money off this and not my family.
Exactly.
Because the Klingon elf is not a big seller. Well, what do you think? Do you think this is going to burn itself out, Aisha, in our last moments here? Or is this going to keep going strong and be a new thing for a long time to come?
I'm going to say that for the next few years, it will keep going strong because there is such a commercial push behind it. But I'll tell you what, I bet the kids who grew up with the Elf on the Shelf are really not going to want to do all that for their kids. They're going to be like, oh, this was nice, but we really don't have time for this for our own kids.
Well, Aisha, thank you so much for joining us and talking about Elf on a Shelf today.
Absolutely. Thanks, guys. You have a wonderful Christmas.
You too.
We've been speaking with Aisha Sultan, syndicated parenting columnist at the St. Louis Post-Dispatch.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert.
It's time for our weekly news roundup. In this edition, new job numbers and a tough time connecting with unemployment benefits, the John Doe case in the state's Supreme Court, and skiing. News guy Noah Ovshinsky brings us up to date. Noah, welcome back.
It's good to be here. Thanks, Rob, and happy Friday.
Happy Friday to you. Now, let's touch base on a story we've been watching for a while, this John Doe investigations. Some news from the state Supreme Court on this one.
Yeah, so the Supreme Court agreed this week to hear three cases involving the John Doe investigation. You know, up until now, the investigation really has been in limbo for the last several months. And, you know, this is an indication that they may, in fact, at some point, be some kind of resolution to the John Doe investigation.
All right, give us the story. story so far and what this John Doe investigation was looking at?
Right. So going back in time just a little bit, the now suspended John Doe investigation was looking into whether there was illegal coordination between the Walker campaign and outside political groups during the recall election. A lower court judge effectively stopped that investigation, saying essentially that there was no evidence of wrongdoing. Since then, there have been challenges in federal court that went nowhere, and the Supreme Court has essentially been sitting on this now for almost a year, and now they've decided to take it up.
Okay. Does that mean they're sitting down today? What's the schedule here?
No. The court is now accepting briefs in the cases, and at some point in the next few months, I would think, we'll schedule a hearing, and a ruling could come as early as the summer.
So what's being challenged? What are they going to be trying to rule on here?
So they've taken up a few challenges as it relates to the John Doe investigation, but a lot of people, journalists, the judge who initially stopped the investigation, court watchers, those kinds of folks, say they really hope that the Supreme Court sort of once and for all decides, whether Wisconsin's campaign finance laws are legal in light of the U.S. Supreme Court ruling Citizens United. And in particular, court watchers are looking to see, frankly, from the court, to what extent campaigns can coordinate with outside groups until, disclosure laws and donation caps come into play.
So one perspective and the one the challengers, I guess, would be hoping for would be to say, okay, Citizens United means that this law that is at the center of this investigation is irrelevant.
Essentially,
it is not a legal law as laws go.
Yep.
So the governor and his campaigns have been at the center of all of this. Have we heard from the governor since the Supreme Court made this announcement?
Yeah, he told reporters this week that, he welcomes the Supreme Court's acceptance of the cases. And he says, he hopes it puts the matter to rest once and for all.
And then there's some controversy, I imagine. What are other observers saying about this?
Yeah, there are some legal observers and liberal groups, think that, four justices in the Supreme Court should actually recuse themselves because they've actually received campaign donations from some of the groups that were subjects of the John Doe investigation. No indication that they will, but that is one element of controversy that comes along with the Supreme Court taking up this issue of the John Doe investigation.
And I've seen in the past recusals on those grounds seem to be few and far between.
Yeah, so exactly.
They may not be holding their breath on that one.
Yeah, I think it would be a surprise if they were to recuse themselves.
Well, another story we've been watching a lot, and it doesn't have quite the explosiveness that it has, say, during a governor's race, but some new job numbers out for the state.
Yeah, I think it's a way of taking the pulse of our state's economy, and these are the last job numbers of the year, and they were released this week. And the numbers show that the state has an improving employment picture. Wisconsin added a little more than 16,000 private sector jobs in November. That's bringing the state's unemployment rate down to 5.2%. If you look at year-over-year numbers, for example, not just, November's numbers, comparing November to November, the state created roughly 51,000 jobs in that time.
Now, regular listeners to the segment know there are two sets of numbers, the monthlies and the quarterlies. These are monthlies we're talking about, right?
Right. This is the monthly. And these particular numbers are the monthly numbers. Yep.
Okay. So what kind of jobs do we know are being created here?
Yeah. So there was a strong showing in what is called, in techno terms, the goods producing category. In English, that means that the state is essentially seeing growth in construction and manufacturing. And officials with the Walker administration say there has been also some growth in professional business services.
Well, one of the big controversies during election season was, okay, we've got these numbers. How do they compare to the rest of the country? So how do these numbers compare to the rest of the country?
Right. Well, when you compare Wisconsin to other states and other states in the Midwest, frankly, we are still lagging. We are ranked 32nd in the nation in terms of job growth and last in the Midwest. And I'll just mention one more set of numbers. I don't want to bombard you with numbers. I'll give you one more set just to sort of put Wisconsin in context. Job growth in Wisconsin was around 1.5% from June of 2013 to June of this year. Okay? 1.5%. The national average is 2.3% in that time.
Okay. So in that measure, too, lagging the national numbers.
Exactly. Yeah. You compare 1.5% in Wisconsin to the national average of 2.3%.
Well, a related topic on unemployment. Now, the Legislative Audit Bureau, been in the news a lot lately. They've been auditing like crazy.
Yes, they're auditing everything,
it seems like, and that includes the Department of Workforce Development. So what's the story there this week?
Yeah, and this audit looked, among other things, at the kind of customer service people who were seeking info about unemployment received.
And so I'm like a person, I'm trying to get unemployment, I'm calling or going online, I'm trying to get some help.
Exactly. You're calling the hotline, and they were looking at what kind of service you received. And basically what the Legislative Audit Bureau found was that people applying for unemployment benefits had a really hard time getting through the system. The LAB found that 1.7 million calls were actually dropped.
So why? What are they finding? What's behind that?
Well, among other things, there was a big jump in calls, and frankly, the department was ill-equipped to deal with it. You know, normally around 7,500 people call the state's unemployment number each week. Mm-hmm. If you look at last December and January, that number jumped to 93,000. So, frankly, they were overwhelmed.
So this audit, you said last December and January. So this is looking at the last, I guess, fiscal year.
Yep.
Have we seen a change since then, or do we know?
Yeah. Well, Republican State Representative Samantha Kirkman, who co-chairs the audit committee, says the situation has improved, but there's still some issues, especially with those who have complicated applications. Governor Walker also weighing in. He says the situation has improved. He says DWD Secretary Reggie Newsom told him in the spring that nobody has been dropped in this new fiscal year. And, you know, the governor says changes in staffing and the introduction of an online application has, you know, relieved the pressure on DWD.
So that's from the governor. Democrats weighing in on this?
Yeah. Assembly Democratic leader Peter Barca released a statement on the day that the audit was released. And frankly, he accused the Republicans of mismanagement. He says the DWD was, in effect, putting up hurdles for the unemployed.
All right. Well, that'll be another one to watch going forward. Well, let's journey outside of Madison a little bit, outside of the state capital. Some economic news and recreational news from a little bit north of here.
Yeah. So in Wausau, Granite Peak announced, which is the Granite Peak ski area, which is just in the Wausau area. They announced this week that they are going to ask the DNR to lease them an additional 150 acres in the Rib Mountain State Park. The operator there wants to add some more downhill runs and cross-country trails that can also be used in the summer for hiking.
Mm-hmm. And any other parts of that plan?
Yeah. Granite Peak is also looking to build a lodge on land that it already owns.
Okay, and that sounds like possible economic benefit for the area, I guess, would be the argument for it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Wausau tourism officials, you know, they welcome the announcement. You know, they say it will really help the local economy. Granite Peak says it expects this expansion, or I should say this proposed expansion, to almost double the amount of visits from like 110,000 a year to 200,000 a year. You know, that's a lot more skiers.
Mm-hmm. So this is in a state park. So what's the process there? What happens next?
Right. So there will be public hearings that will deal with the request from Granite Peak. And then the development plan will be submitted to the Natural Resources Board, who will then consider the request to lease Granite Peak the additional acres in the state park.
Well, whether this happens or not, Noah, are you a downhill skiing person?
I was. I used to be. And I keep on threatening to go back out on the hills, but it has not happened yet.
I went up for the first time in the Wausau area just a couple years ago. My limbs, all intact,
well,
I have
well
to say.
Done. Well done.
I went down only the sub bunny hill. my kids were a little more adventurous, but yeah, we all walked away, and that's a good thing.
A very good thing.
Well, Noah, thanks as always.
It was good to be here. Thanks, Rob.
That was WPR's Assistant News Director Noah Ovchinsky. He joins us each week at this time to catch us up on the latest in Wisconsin news. And by the way, next Friday, he'll join us for a year-end look at a lot of the big issues, the stories, like that governor race. Remember that? That was this year. All the top stories in Wisconsin politics and news in 2014. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.